the ritual developments which you found in the early Soviet Russia, the virtual deification of Stalin, the mausoleum of Lenin, and so on. So this is also true. Thirdly, however, we must say that it may have gone wrong because of programmatic errors of Marx himself, or possibly other socialists directly inspired by Marx. And this also seems to me to be undoubtedly true. For instance, there is no doubt that traditional socialism, including Marx, envisaged sooner or later the total elimination of the market. Different forms of exchange, but not the exchange through the market with market prices. Now, insofar as this was attempted, it didn't work. It probably couldn't work. There is an interesting recent book by Stanley Moore, a philosopher from San Diego, which suggests that one of the reasons why Marx had great difficulty in the last years in completing his work is that while he wanted to maintain communism, he found it impossible, as it were, to do so. The economics of communism, as he analyzed it, wouldn't work out. This may or may not be true, but the fact is that insofar as Marx envisaged a socialist economy without the market, by direct allocation or some other direct form of allocation, it was also bound to fail. Now, we don't know what Marx would have thought if he had been obliged to consider the concrete problems of creating a socialist economy. He never considered these, and for various reasons, the early socialist movements spent no time at all considering what they would have to do when they got power. Perhaps because of Marx's dislike of utopian projects. So it is possible that had he found himself in the situation, he might have come to different conclusions, but we don't know what he would have thought. And he didn't think about it, and to this extent, the Soviet Union failed also because there are elements in Marx's own thought which were impracticable or didn't work. So, one way or another, the second half of the famous thesis on Feuerbach has turned out to be very much harder than Marx thought. Changing the world is not so easy. This doesn't necessarily invalidate the first half, the question of interpreting the world. However, Marx said a great deal by way of interpreting the world, and not all of it is equally convincing. My own view is that the central element in Marxism is the materialist conception of history. Indeed, this was the view of the Second International. It was specifically, I think, expressed by Kautsky in his polemic against Bernstein, where he said that he defined Marxism as the method which arises from the application of the materialist conception of history to politics. Kautsky wrote as a politician, but nevertheless the centrality of this method seems to me he and the Second International was correct. Much more central than certain other elements of Marxism, for instance, whatever it is, alienation or the various Hegelian aspects of the philosophy. I believe this remains valid, and I believe that this is the center of, shall we say, the at least the historian's approach to the Marxist method today. I don't personally want to express an opinion here on the various other aspects of Marxist theory, of philosophy, on economic analysis and so on, except insofar as these bear on historical materialism. Nor do I want to express an opinion on the various formulations of Marxism as a total view of everything, which has been put forward very notably in the Bolshevik period, but I think the classical Marxism associated with the Soviet period is actually, in certain respects, a linear continuation of Kautskyan developments in the Second International. I don't believe that the materialist conception of history is necessarily connected with Marxist theory of value. It has been possible, for instance, for Jerry Cohen, in his book on Marxism, to reformulate Marxism without the theory of value, but maintaining a particular version of the materialist conception of history. I am not clear how far the Marxist method in history requires one to have a Hegelian philosophy. There are schools of Marxists, for instance the Austro-Marxists in the early part of the century, who were certainly Marxist in their approach to history, but who did not accept the Hegelian philosophy, but were, if anything, neo-Kantians. I express no opinion on this, because it seems to me, I merely point out that this is not something that we need to consider, at least I. However, I think two things need to be said in general. First of all, we have to remember that Marx was a 19th century thinker, and in many respects a highly characteristic 19th century thinker. If you read, for instance, what Marx wrote about nations and nationalism, there is nothing specifically Marxist in there. You will find exactly the same approaches in John Stuart Mill and in almost anybody else who wrote in the middle of the 19th century and dealt with these subjects. And we've got to remember the extent to which a great deal that we think of as characteristic of Marxism was simply what every intelligent and well-educated and philosophically minded thinker in the 19th century, unless they were Catholics or reactionaries, believed. The belief in progress, the belief in a gradual evolution through stages of the human race, and a number of other things of this kind. So one of the things that needs to be done is clearly to liberate, if you like, or to peel off those bits of Marxism which are merely characteristic of the period in which he thought. Now, of course, if we believe still valid, we don't need to peel them off, but they are not necessarily typically or specifically Marxist. Secondly, and I've already made this point in another lecture, that Marx was both an analyst and a prophet. In fact, biographically, he became a communist first and then elaborated an analysis to demonstrate that his conclusions were historically inevitable. Now, We must distinguish, it seems to me, between these two aspects of the thinker. We must distinguish between what he predicted because he wanted it to be true, and what he predicted because it followed from the analysis of the real development of society which he made. For instance, the future triumph of communism does not necessarily follow from the analysis. What follows from the analysis is the possible elements of a breakdown of capitalism which might be superseded by another form of society, but it does not follow that this society is necessarily going to be communist in the sense in which Marx intended originally. So we have to make the distinction. Again, the dynamics of capitalist development allow Marx to make certain predictions which prove to be highly relevant. For instance, the tendency for a competitive capitalism of small units to give way to economic concentration and greater monopoly and so on. On the other hand, the prediction that the working class would prove to be the grave digger because increasingly there would be a polarization of the population which it virtually eliminated the capital, the elements of bourgeoisie, did not prove to be correct and probably expressed a hope as much as a reality. It did represent an analysis to some extent. For instance, it was actually a rather good medium-term prediction that the working increase with industrialization. When Marx wrote, there were very few workers, and indeed between, let us say, the 1860s and the 1950s, it proved to be a very correct prediction that the workers would increase and become increasingly a major part of the population. But it did not follow that this process of polarization would continue indefinitely. And there was nothing in the Marxist analysis as against the Marxist hope which would actually demonstrate this. So, allowing for this general thing, what then was Marx's approach to the materialist conception of history? I avoid using the word historical materialism because it was associated later on with a doctrine in the Bolshevik period, you see, which included a large number of other things. So I prefer Marx's own term of the materialist conception of history. This conception of history, and I quote Marx from really the first clear formulation of it in the German ideology, this conception of history relies on expounding the real process of production, starting from the material production of life itself, and comprehending the form of intercourse with and created by this mode of production. That is to say, civil society in its various stages as the basis of all history. We describe this in its action as a state and also explain how all the different theoretical products and forms of consciousness, religion, philosophy, morality, and so on, arise from it, tracing this process of their formation from that basis. And thus, it is possible to depict the whole thing in its totality, and therefore also the reciprocal action of these various aspects on one another. In a single sentence, it is the social being of humans which determines their consciousness and not the other way around. Now, this is the basic approach of Marx, which he maintained, Marx and Engels, which he maintained from the German ideology in the middle 40s on, and you will find exactly the same thing elaborated in different ways in the classical text, which is, as you know, the preface to the Critique of Political Economy in 1859, and indeed up to the end of Marx's works. Now, the point is that what he is proposing here is not a set of findings about the development of humanity. It is a program, if you like, of research. It is, as it were, a general model, not so much even of the interconnections between different aspects of history, but of the way in which one should approach the analysis and the investigation of these various aspects. Process starting with the real process of production, starting from the material production of life itself, and comprehending the whole form of intercourse in which human beings engage on that basis. Now remember, once again, that for Marx, this is not a set of conclusions about it. As he himself said, and I quote once again the German ideology, the abstractions in which you sum up the general development of humanity, which can conclude, these, divorced from real history, I'm quoting Marx again, have no value whatsoever. They can only serve to facilitate the arrangement of historical material, to indicate the sequence of its separate strata, but they by no means afford a recipe or schema, as does philosophy, for neatly trimming the epochs of history into shape. It is extremely important for Marx. These things are methods, shall we say, not methods, but guides, as it were, and not a set, what he calls a schema for trimming the epochs of philosophy of history into shape. Now, this, it seems to me, in this respect, the method of interpreting the world maintains its value in general. Its key clearly is what came to be called the relation between base and superstructure, namely the material base on which, to quote the preface, there arises a superstructure of ideas, philosophy, and so on. Now note that for Marx, once again, what he calls the real process of production is not just a narrow economic concept, what Marx called the material production of life. It is a much more complex process of interaction between humans. If I may quote Eric Wolff, it is a complex set of mutually dependent relations among nature, work, social labor, and social organization. And note also that Marx knew this from the beginning, of course, and stressed it, that humans produce not only with hand but also with the head. In other words, they operate, human production operate through consciousness, through language, through concepts, and cannot possibly operate in any other way. The adaptation of humans, for instance, to the environment is not, as in the case of whatever it is, birds or animals, either a matter of natural selection without consciousness, or internalized in the form of instinct and instinctive behavior. It operates through thinking, formulating, speaking, communicating, and the formation of ideas. This is obviously, and indeed, I repeat that the identification of Marxist history with economic history, or even with economic determinism in history, is and always has been erroneous. It's quite true that the initial explosive impact of reading the Marxist, reading Marx, on other historians or social scientists was largely due to bringing superstructural elements in direct relationship with elements of the base. But that was not the whole of it. Now, I don't, of course, wish to deny the existence of a direct determination of superstructural elements, culture, ideas, institutions, through the economic or material base. Sometimes, for instance, we can obviously demonstrate that certain, particularly in the modern period, that certain modern, certain cultural developments or ideal developments would not have been possible without the development of certain material conditions. I mentioned the case of cinema, film, you see, or photography, and the effect which the rise of photography had on the development of the arts. This is a technical development which has a direct impact on cultural things. Again, it is perfectly clear that in some ways shall we say the experience of particular social experiences of social events or developments has a direct impact on the development of ideas. It's a well-known fact that Charles Darwin's theory of evolution and natural selection was very largely based on Malthus, the theory of Thomas Malthus, his theory of population, and that this in turn was based on actually attempting to solve the problems he believed which existed of a necessarily growing overpopulation in the early capitalist England of the early 19th century. So to this extent, there is no doubt that we can, if we so wish, find direct cases where superstructural ideas, cultures, and other things are directly determined, or at any rate conditioned, are made possible by. Nevertheless, if I may mention another thing, the modern youth culture, including, for instance, modern popular music, rests on a single fact which could be observed in England and the United States in the 1950s, the emergence of teenage human beings as a market. These, for the first time, earned money for themselves, were capable of spending money on things they wanted, and virtually the entire entertainment industry was based on this new fact. Straight economic fact. So much so that by the 1960s, 1970s, the American and indeed Anglo-Saxon popular music industry, phonographs and other things, relied for 80% of its production and its profits on the narrow age range of people buying it between the ages of 14 and 21. probably never has a cultural industry relied on so narrow an age band. And the reasons why it did so aren't simply that there were so many of these kids, but that they had money to spend, whereas people of older generations had other things on which to spend their income. So I am far from underestimating the sheer old-fashioned economic element in the relations between the base and superstructure. However, recently a number of very serious criticisms have been put forward of the base superstructural model, which were not available in Marx's days and even later on. Partly as they are criticisms which I already mentioned in earlier talks, for instance, because the very concepts of base and superstructure are, as it were, retrospective distinctions which the societies themselves do not necessarily have, the societies to which we apply it. Partly because the relations of production themselves, or so it can be argued, are structured by the culture and the concepts which we apply to them. And so these cannot be reduced to the reflections or products of the relations of production. But most seriously, there is a critique which is essentially based on the modern developments of social anthropology, or if you like, cultural anthropology. And it is essentially that a given mode of production is compatible with a large number of types of concepts or forms of social behavior. And that consequently, it is not possible to establish a one-to-one correspondence between a particular mode of material production and the superstructure. It is better, therefore, to analyze superstructure and ideas in other terms. For instance, in Levi-Straussian structural terms, to name but one, namely as the variation of a limited number of elements rather than as the causal connection between social and economic structure and the ideas arising out of it. Now, this is certainly very powerful. Indeed, it's powerful because it's quite clear, at least in earlier societies, that the variation between cultures, between, if you like, superstructures, is far greater than the variation in the range of their material base. In most farming and pastoral communities, for instance, there is only a comparatively limited range. For instance, over the world as a whole, there's only a fairly limited range of basic crops or domesticated animals, or of combinations of the two. However, the range of the cultural, the religious, the ritual, the kinship, the forms of kinship organization of the societies which live by this comparatively limited range is enormous. If you look particularly if they're isolated from each other, as for instance in Papua New Guinea, you find basically similar material base of production and an enormous range of almost unlimited variety of superstructures, of ways in which they organize themselves and have their social practices. These, of course, are subject to what might be called the principle of limited choice. In some instances, there are physically no, there's only a limited number of things. For instance, there's a famous principle among anthropologists that there can only be a limited number of forms of marriage, because it's either one man, one woman, or one man, several women, or one woman, several men, or several men, several women. And this exhausts, insofar as there is a regular arrangement, this exhausts all the possibilities. And so all marriage systems have got to conform to one or other of these limited possibilities. Nevertheless, allowing for this, there still is an enormous range, or an apparently enormous range. Now, one reason, of course, for this enormous range might actually be built into the material base of production. Because this infinite variability may occur, because in effect the basic unit of society, of social reproduction and production, is a very small one and which is still very largely independent of other such units. You can see this especially in these areas like, say, Papua New Guinea, where virtually you have self-contained societies and economies which coexist with others, which fight from time to time with them, but essentially are independent. Now, if as it were, the world, the orbis terrarum, consists of a large number of small and relatively self-contained units which don't actually need each other very much, you see, then it is not surprising that each of these units considers itself as the only world, you see, and develops a number of institutions which have no necessary connection with others, subject to various things such as, for instance, institutions of exogamy. If you have to choose your spouses from other societies, that may change affairs. In short, you very often find, perhaps normally find, that in small societies like this, the members describe themselves as a human race. They say, we are people, the others aren't really people, the others exist somewhere outside. You know, this is a classical form of behavior which is socially based, not culturally based, and which actually survives into modern times in the form of ethnic, cultural identities, nationalisms, and so on, just as in the old days Greeks said, we are the only people, the others are barbarians, they can't even talk properly, you see. Didn't mean they can't talk properly, they knew perfectly well that the Persians talked, communicated, but the only form of language that was recognized as properly human was our language. The others were, as it were, outside. Similarly, the Slavs, who talked about everybody else as Niemetsi, people who can't talk, you see. Now, given this situation of, as it were, a very, one can't even call it decentralized, I mean, humanity as a set of separate small units developing as such, variability of cultural forms on the basis of a lesser variability of material and other things is to be expected and is not natural. The other thing is, of course, that for most of these people, in a sense, it is not yet possible to generalize beyond the range of, as it were, the economy. In other words, concepts for describing the world as a whole do not yet exist. What exists are concepts for describing what exists within this comparatively small orb, within this infinite assembly of comparatively small societies, each going about their business of producing and reproducing themselves. This too, in some sense, survives, in a sense, the capacity to develop, even in ritual terms, general religions comes relatively late. We can actually specify at what stage of history general religions with general ideas about the gods develop. But initially, there is no such thing as a god or even the Olympus. There are our gods, our spirits, our demons, which have a connection with this particular place or the particular places which we are. So that in a sense, later on, these cults or something may be integrated in broader things, so that the local saint is regarded as merely a local subspecies of a general species. But initially, what counts is not the Virgin Mary and Jesus Christ, but the local saint and the local cult and the local, which probably has specific connections with all manner of localities. So to this extent, it seems to me that the enormous variability of what later on could be called superstructural is built into, in effect, the structure of the mode of production at a certain stage. We could initially also add that the relatively low technology, or shall we say, the comparatively limited capacity to influence nature, also necessitates, as well as encourages, a profusion, a vast development, if you like, of modes of attempting to influence nature by means which today we would call spiritual or magical or in other ways. You see, the less you can influence nature, the more you have to find other ways of doing so, and there is an enormous range in which you could possibly do this. Nevertheless, given all this, the material base is where we start from, and moreover, it can provide and it must provide the limits within which there is variation. For instance, in hunting-gathering societies, food, the means of production or reproduction, are available for anyone with the ability to get it. The crucial business is whether you are able to get it, but if you are physically and so on, then anyone can get the food. So, the organization of society, which is invariably in the basis of kinship of some kind or other, and the ideology of which kinship is a basis, needs to be defined only laterally. Only, as it were, who has the right to priorities here, there, within the existing group. There is no need to develop any large-scale, even kinship organization, which goes across the generations. Each generation, as it were, confronts the problem of the means of production and how to get it in the same way. However, what is more, in hunting-gathering societies, with rare exception, permanent surpluses are not possible. Or if they are possible, you don't know what to do with it. There's no function. You can, for instance, develop it into potlatches or into redistributed. I mean, there are some hunting-gathering societies which get an awful lot of, such as in fishing societies on the Pacific coast of Canada, which actually can gain far more food than they need. So therefore what you have is what the economist, the anthropologist Marshall Salim has called the Stone Age affluence. You can get everything you need and the rest you take out in leisure, in games, in ritual, you know, because there is no particular point in accumulating, you see. Now, in agricultural societies, once you have the invention of agriculture, which also goes with various technologies and organizations, all this changes. For one thing, the economy provides the basis for permanent surpluses, which can be appropriated. It provides a basis, for instance, for class society, and for permanent power, and incidentally for permanent cultural and spiritual specialists, for permanent priests. But what has to be decided, of course, is the allocation of means of production, because from now on they are limited, because there is a limit to land. There is a limit to the number of flocks in pastoral societies. The question of who gets what part becomes essential. And social arrangements for the division of this, and what is more, for the inheritance of it, for the division across generations, become essential. How these arrangements are made varies, no doubt. But these decisions now have to be taken, and institutions have to be developed for them, and ideas about these things have to be developed. How is the surplus to be utilized? Who is to get it? How is the appropriation of the surplus, for instance, by a ruling class to be legitimated? All these now arise. However, I therefore clear in my own mind that you must nevertheless begin the analysis of cultural, superstructural ideas and so on by the analysis of the mode and social relations of production. However, what is clear is that once these superstructural forms have been formed, they become forces themselves which constrain the development of the base. This is not, of course, an argument against Karl Marx, because that actually is the essence of Marx's argument of revolution. Namely, that a superstructure, an inflexible superstructure, which at one time has been a force for economic progress, becomes a break on economic progress, and if that progress is to continue, it has to be broken suddenly. The integument has to be broken. The most recent illustration of this here is precisely the fall of the Soviet Union. What we see is that a system which initially was designed to create rapid industrialization and the rapid emergence from economic backwardness succeeded up to a point in doing so, but beyond that point it became equally clear that the superstructure became a break on development, and the people engaged in development, the managers, the new middle class, the professionals who had grown up within it, found it was impossible to continue developing this within this framework, and the framework was ruptured, broken. It doesn't follow, and this is where we disagree with Marx, that the results of such a rupture are always and necessarily progressive. in the case of the Soviet Union, what happens is not that a better system was substituted, but that for the time being, chaos and anarchy and a breakdown were substituted. Nevertheless, the operation of breaking through an inflexible, a rigid superstructure which constrains the economy and which constrains the progress of science and the force of production, this is the Soviet Union was, I'm sorry to say, a clear example of the validity of Marxism, or at least of this. Remember, I mean, this can be demonstrated. Remember, for instance, that in the Soviet Union, only 1/3 of the inventions made within the Soviet economy found any kind of economic expression. And I guess most of those were utilized in the military-industrial complex. This was an economy which would grow from nothing to becoming a major industrial economy and then could not, within that framework, go any further. You see? This, I think, is essentially the procedure which Marx supposed to happen periodically in history, and therefore the force of superstructural institutional elements can come. In this sense, however, we can say, and we must say, that superstructural elements shape the base or stop it developing and have their own independent force. But then, as I repeat, Marx never denied this. There is, however, another aspect of it, which I think Marx underestimated, but of which we are increasingly conscious. And that is, superstructural elements are not necessarily rigid. They are, in many cases, adaptable, often infinitely adaptable. For instance, it is perfectly possible, let us take the case of kinship organization, the family, you see. The family is in one way or another, can be adapted to a variety of economic and social situations and assimilated to this and become functionally integrated into them. Other examples which you know is monarchy. Monarchy for long periods was an institution for the governance of most large states. In the 19th, 20th century, on the whole, it is no longer necessary, but we know that in several countries, monarchies have adapted themselves to this new situation. And in one or two instances, even, the case of Spain is a typical one, people have discovered that under certain circumstances, this rather old-fashioned way of organizing things may have temporary political advantages. So here we have a very considerable flexibility. We not only are the Marx considered the inflexibility of the superstructure, we must bear in mind also the considerable within limits, the considerable flexibility. How far, however, should we include elements as independent factors or variables which other thinkers have paid a great deal of attention to? I'm thinking of Max Weber, who is in some ways the great counter force to Marx, even though he is in some ways also the supplement to Marx. Weber, for instance, like Marx, paid a great deal of attention to power in politics, but Weber paid more attention to power as an independent variable. As you know, Max Weber and Weberians stress the division of the functional division of power as an important historical variable. As you know, he distinguishes between three types of power: the economic, the military-political, and the spiritual. in some ways rather like the like the medieval division, which I referred to earlier on, between the oratores, the bellatores, and the laboratores, you see. Except that in most societies before capitalists, the laboratores didn't have any kind of power, the productive ones. Economic power was always subject to military, political, or spiritual power. I think this is important. Nevertheless, this does not explain the basic evolution of human societies. It helps, if you like, in classifying them, but it is not a built-in dynamic of social evolution. Similarly, with ideas or concepts, which Weber once again pays a great deal of attention, if there is any theory of historical evolution in Max Weber, it would be essentially a natural long-term tendency towards the growth of rationality and generalization. This takes place, but I do not see that it is in fact an adequate independent force. Where does this growth of rationality come from, unless we suppose that it is somehow built into human evolution as such? And it doesn't work. It seems to me, in many ways, the Weberian view that it is the spirit of Protestantism which creates capitalism is the opposite of the truth. And there are people like Joseph Schumpeter who took the same view, saying this is a pseudo-problem. It isn't. You don't explain capitalism by the independent emergence of some special idea. The ideas may, under certain circumstances, determine why certain countries or certain countries are more successful in certain economic activities than others. For instance, why capitalism developed more rapidly in Protestant countries than in Catholic countries. But they do not explain the development of capitalism as such. There's only one point at which, it seems to me, ideas do become independent productive forces. And this is in the contemporary period, when production depends on a scientific technology which could not possibly have developed except on the basis of independent institutions for developing ideas and science. Soviet Marxism recognized this in its last stages, that in the modern high technology society, you cannot distinguish the ideas involved in scientific research from forces of production. At this stage, it becomes very difficult to separate the two. There is a great debate on this, in my view, because some people, some historians, including Marxist historians, believe that even in the earlier stages of industrialization, the independent force of new scientific ideas, scientific innovation, and especially the new scientific worldview, was essential to the development of industrialization. Professor Margaret Jacob in New York takes this view. So what I'm saying isn't necessarily what is a general view. However, I don't believe that until the late 19th century, techno-scientific development became an independent force which determined subsequent developments. So, I see the preface to the Critique of Political Economy and what Marx said into it still essentially as an adequate basis for the approach to history. But I see this as a research program, as a guide to priorities rather than as a mechanism for explaining history. If we are going to be historians, I don't only mean Marxist historians, but certainly if we are going to be Marxist historians, it seems to me we have to have, as it were, an order of priorities in our research. We begin with the material and historical environment. We go on to the forces and techniques of production, with demography coming somewhere in between. We then elaborate the structure of the subsequent economy, the consequent economy, the divisions of labor within it, the exchange of accumulation, of the distribution of the surplus. We then naturally investigate the social relations which arise out of these, and the institutions and the images of the society and its functioning, which again arise on this basis. And of course, we may or may not be tempted as historians to pick on particular relations and particular images characteristic, but whatever we do, we essentially begin as with an order of priorities. If you wish to understand 19th century society, it is no use beginning with a basic philosophical assumption and trying to see 19th century as the realization of some a priori philosophical assumptions. You have to begin, for practical purposes, with what is clearly the dominant phenomenon in it, namely the development of a capitalist economy, a bourgeois society, and the conquest of the world by this society, not, of course, universally and simultaneously, but in an uneven and combined form. But if you don't begin with this, where sooner or later you find yourself up into a blind alley. You cannot go any further. And so I think it is in this term that we must find our, we must use the Marxist method. There is, however, one problem with which I will conclude. I hope to be able to say some more about it later on, possibly on Monday. And it is this. Marx assumed a basic tendency for the forces of production to grow, and in doing so to destabilize the superstructures erected on the various modes of production in the course of this development. Now, it is quite true that if you look at human history as a whole, from the Stone Age to the present, there is such a tendency. It is the only undeniable tendency that human beings today have a far greater control over nature, a far greater capacity to produce, including to produce themselves. That the human race is today far larger and maintained by its capacity to produce. And yet, if we actually look at history concretely, we do not find a constant tendency. We find two major leaps forward in the development of the human capacity to, if you like, produce. The one is, if you like, the Neolithic Revolution, the invention of agriculture, of cities, of metalwork, and all the rest of it, and the other is modern industrialization. And what I think Marx himself did not adequately investigate, perhaps because he was really only interested in one particular aspect, namely the emergence and the development of capitalism, was why, in fact, you have this bumpiness, this unevenness in the general tendency, that you do not have a steady growth of the forces of production, but a periodic burst of release for the forces of production. And this, it seems to me, is the major problem, historically speaking, that any historian, including Marxist historian, sooner or later has to face. I think it is easier to solve for the first of these great bumps, the Neolithic Revolution, than it is for the second. And most of the current debate, not only among Marxists, but even among all historians trying to see human history as a whole, the problem that Marx originally formulated, the origin, development, its peak, its full development in the form of a modern industrial capitalist society with the extraordinary release of productive forces in this. I don't think Marx has the answer, but I think Marx had the question. I don't think anybody else had the question. They too find themselves forced back on Marx's question, even if they provide other answers. Remains an essential starting point for history, although not the finishing post. But whether, of course, those who go into history call themselves Marxists or not, seems to me to be a secondary question. I personally continue to do so, partly out of sense of obligation to a great thinker who has inspired me and a large number of other people. I see no reason why people who believe in evolution shouldn't call themselves Darwinians, even if they don't actually believe really that Darwin was right, and for the same reason. But whether you call yourself Darwinian or whether you call yourself Marxist or not is not important. The important thing is that you proceed in the manner originally by or introduced by these great thinkers. Thank you. At this point, I will conclude.
Entiendo muy bien el inglés. Tal vez que hay preguntas para clarificar algo que...